just want to be 19. We've here got the law's teaching about slander and false witness. I'll just read it through from verse 18. So the judges are to make diligent inquisition, and if the witness is a false witness and has testified falsely against his brother, that is, trying to get his brother condemned in court for a certain issue that he's fabricated, then you must do to him as he had thought to do to his brother. I understand that means that he is to have done to him the punishment that the false witness was seeking to get done against his brother. So you shall put away the evil from the midst of you. Those who remain shall hear and fear, and shall henceforth commit no more any such evil in the midst of you. Well, any such evil. This is an evil. To slander, to make up a story against another person is an evil. And the idea is this has got to be punished so that other people learn. And your eye must not pity. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. This eye for an eye business, then, it means that what you intended to do or get done by way of judgment upon your brother is to be done to you if you slandered and made up a case. Well, of course, Jesus does quote this eye for an eye thing and say, you look, just forgive. So that is the higher standard, if we are slandered, is to forgive. And when he says, you know, they said an eye for an eye, of course, the spirit of the law of Moses was generally not actually an eye for an eye. But in this matter, it certainly was an eye for an eye. And Jesus is saying then that in these cases, forgive. The higher path is to forgive. And that is always there, I do believe. But I think we can learn some principles from this. Why this apparent strict judgment? That the judgment here of the law of Moses is, by the way, far more lenient than what is carried out in most societies today. If, for example, somebody creates a story that, I don't know, a man raped a woman, and, well, the penalty for rape is, what, 10 years in jail or whatever it might be in whatever society you live in. It could be death in some Muslim societies. Okay, the idea is, well, if you're proven to have made up that accusation, then this shall be done to you. If there's a 10-year sentence for what you're trying to claim somebody did, then you go for 10 years. If it's a death sentence, well, then you better be killed as well. That is actually far more lenient. If you look at most sort of judicial judgments that are handed down in most countries, it's far more lenient on the person who is fabricating the story. Sure, they are punished to some degree, but far less than the sentence which would have been applied to the person they were slandering. God's position here is far stricter, that the slanderer has got to be punished according to the tariff of punishment which would have gone on the person who they falsely accused. And I think that is because he really hates slander. He really hates making up lies about your brother or sister. And I think the way that human judgment systems reduce that, as I say, generally most judicial systems are far more lenient to the slanderer. I think that's because it reflects our natural sort of human sense that, well, it was just words. Okay, yeah, it was just words. It wasn't actually action. Well, as far as God is concerned, the thought and the word is the action. That's the whole point. And yet, let's just think a little bit more about slander. Is it really so that somebody just wakes up one morning and thinks, I shall slander my neighbor. I shall create a bad story about them. I think that is rather simplistic. One of the critical things in the Christian life is to speak the truth in our hearts. And in fact, when David says that, he's sort of saying that is the essence of the epitome of being a spiritual person, to speak the truth in your heart, in your self-talk, to be truthful. especially when it comes to your images of other people. Problem is, we tend not to be like that, and we tend to have a huge love for conspiracy theories. Then we may say, oh no, I'm not like that. I don't listen to all the rubbish that I see on the internet. I don't believe conspiracy theories. Well, whether we do or we don't, I'm saying that there is a strong tendency within human nature towards conspiracy theory. And the fact that conspiracy theories, no matter how bizarre they are in fact extremely popular in society, well, that just shows that that is true, that that is part of our tendency by nature to believe conspiracy theories, to fantasize about the possible evil of other people. So the problem is that we begin with a jealousy, a grudge, a gut feeling dislike against another person. And then we look at all their behavior in a negative way. And we start to string things together. Take an example. There may be a brother, maybe, in your church, who sometimes just doesn't turn up at church for 2 or 3 weeks and his phone's off. Can't seem to get hold of him. When he does turn up, he turns up rather last minute and leaves fairly early. And sometimes he looks a bit rough, looks a bit beat up. And, well, occasionally you notice his hands are shaking. And you get this hunch, because you know an alcoholic whose hands shake, you just get this hunch he's an alcoholic. And, well, you see him just walking past maybe a bottle store, an off-license late at night one evening as you're driving through a certain suburb, and the guy's not in the shop. He just happened to be walking past it. And you think, uh-huh, yeah, there you are. And so it develops in your mind. You make all the connections and you assume that whatever evidence you see about this person fits in that narrative that is forming. You're not speaking the truth in your heart. You are not following 1 Corinthians 13 to have the love that thinks no evil. And before you know where you are, you have developed this more than suspicion that he's an alcoholic. And so it goes on, and then in conversation, Jim's a strange guy, or whoever it is. This is all genuinely purely fictional. You come out with it to a few people and say, you know what, I reckon he's an alcoholic. And then it goes on and someone else repeats that, and then you repeat it more strongly sometime later. It could be a year later. Not, I reckon Jim's an alcoholic. Jim's an alcoholic. And so the picture continues. What might be the case with this fictional character, Jim, is that he was a missionary in the Soviet Union. He was a missionary in a strictly repressive Islamic regime. And the guy's got post-traumatic stress disorder. And he doesn't drink a drop. And yet there are times when his disorder means that, yeah, he is not that functional. He's a passionate guy for the Lord, and he has slight agoraphobia, and it's as much as he can do to be in a crowd of people of any sort. And you've slandered him. Well, this sort of thing goes on all the time. And with the passage of time, I'm afraid these wrong ideas develop. This is a trouble with sin. If you continue in it, it gets more and more powerful and more ingrained. And by keeping on telling yourself in your own self-talk a certain narrative, well, that is then what becomes absolute truth for you. I'm sure we've seen this in cases, particularly sadly, of family breakdown where the ex, over a course of time, becomes more and more persuaded of a certain narrative about their former partner. And they've kept on telling themselves this, that, and the other, and they look at everything in a negative light, and so it develops. And it turns out into slander. And it gets bigger and bigger. Perhaps Jim's not just an alcoholic. Jim's a, I don't know, he's actually also a druggie, and he's a drug dealer. You know, it just mushrooms. This is where utter truthfulness within our own heart is so critical, as well as the love that thinks no evil. Also, why slander? Another window on slander is, I think that it's a tall puppy syndrome. We want to bring other people down a bit more to our standard. This is why people who are often genuinely very spiritually committed in some parts of their lives get jumped on when they may fail in another part of their life. Or even if they don't fail in another part of their life, they get jumped on because we don't want to be challenged by them. Now, this is all the stuff of jealousy. See, jealousy is cruel as the grave, and jealousy involves slander. I don't believe there's anybody who has done any amount of ministry, who has been in Christ for any period of time, who has not suffered slander, often quite serious slander. It seems to go with the territory of serving God. You just look at Moses, you look at Paul, you look at all the great servants of God in the Bible, vast majority of them were viciously slandered. Paul particularly, you read between the lines of his letter to the Corinthians, you know, they didn't like his spirituality. They didn't like the demand he made upon them to follow his passionate example. And so they slandered him. So they pulled him down. There's an appeal for money to help the poor brethren in Judea. Oh, Paul's just trying to get rich out of us. He just wants the money for his own pocket, and so on and so forth. And of course, this ultimately happened with the Lord Jesus. One of the reasons why Jesus was crucified and rejected was simply jealousy that got out of hand, that grew up into slander, into hatred, etc. And this leads me on to something else, that a lot of slander has its root, therefore, not just in jealousy, but in what depth psychologists would call transference. Let's take always a genuinely random examples, fictitious examples. You take the pastor who is having an affair with a woman, and he rants and raves about the evil of adultery. And he goes on about how awful it is, and some guy in the congregation is found to be having an affair with somebody. Oh, bang, you know, he's on and on raving about it, kicks the guy out, judges him really harshly. Afterwards, people say, when it's discovered that the pastor himself is having an affair, they say, that's incredible, it's unbelievable. How could he have been so hypocritical in the very same area that he was weak in? How incredible? Well, it's not incredible at all. Once you understand the psychological processes, this guy, the pastor, is having the affair in his deep subconscious, and we're talking deep subconscious here. The guy feels guilty, and he knows that what he's doing is wrong and merits judgment, God's judgment. And so he transfers all that onto the other guy. And he's zealous in judging the guy because he actually knows that that's what his behavior deserves. Now, it can happen that there isn't actually another guy in the church who's having an affair. And so the pastor who is having the affair slanders somebody. He misuses his position of power and respect amongst the congregation to say, Jimmy over there, or, you know, I keep talking about Jimmy, don't I? Whatever, this brother over there is having an affair. The poor guy's like, no, I'm not. Yes, you are. I saw you. This, that, and the other. Evidence. There you go. You terrible person. No, it's not true. Yes, it's true. I say so. I will absolutely make up all the circumstances that you are. It's true. And he will judge the guy. That happens. This sort of thing happens. Believe me, it happens. Big time. Why? Because he's transferring his guilt. And here we come back to Deuteronomy 19, because here we're told that the false witness is to be punished with the punishment that he sought to get on the other person. And I said that that is far stricter than how most legal systems judge. And I wonder if part of the thinking there by God is that, yes, I know that you will only slander a person, or it's probably the case that you slandered a person to get them judged, because in essence you are doing the same sin or another sin that deserves that kind of judgment. That's why you're slandering. So therefore, if you have slandered somebody and you're demanding they be judged in a certain way, and you have done this, well, you know, you're asking them to be judged on the basis of your false witness, because you yourself are guilty. God sees all the depth psychology. He sees all the transference. So that would make perfect sense, because God sees that. He's saying, look, if you're slandering a guy over something and they want they're to get judgment X because of your slander, yeah, that's only because you are doing an equivalent sin that also deserves judgment X. So therefore, if it's found that you are guilty of slander, judgment X will come upon you. So slander is an evil. And as I say, there is nobody who has not experienced this, I don't think, or has not come close to people who have experienced it. This is what rips churches apart, it rips families apart, it rips human relationships apart. And God knows that. And that's why the judgment here, the thinking here in Deuteronomy 19 is as it is. And he says, you've got to put this away from amongst you. In other words, if somebody does it and gets away with it, other people are going to do the same. This sort of misbehavior spreads very quickly. We need to take a very strong line on it, very strong line indeed. And especially to look at ourselves and to speak the truth in our hearts and to have the love that does not believe evil.